Okay, we're going to call the Senate Finance meeting to order. Today is Monday, January 27th. Appreciate everyone showing up here today. I understand that we're having some problems getting planes in and out of Juneau, so we're a little short-handed as far as members present at the table, but we do have members stuck in airports and at LIOs who will be calling in. So I believe Senator Olson will join us from Fairbanks when he can get to a facility. Senator Hoffman is here. Senator Dunleavy is here. Vice Chair Fairclough, are you online?
Senator Meyer, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Okay. Thank you for joining us, Senator Fairclough.
And Senator Meyer, I'm going to put you on mute because I'm in an airport.
I understand. And then Senator Bishop from Fairbanks, are you with us in Fairbanks, Senator Bishop?
I am. You're looking good.
Okay, very good. All right. Thanks for joining us, Senator Bishop, and hope you can get here when you can, but be safe. And Senator Kelly and then myself, Senator Meyer. Okay, so today, on today's agenda, we have commercial agreements for the Alaska LNG project, and the members will note that the Department of Revenue has provided us with a handy-dandy three-ring binder that contains the commercial agreements and information pertaining to the legislation that was introduced by the governor, which is on another committee referral and is not before us yet and is not subject of the meeting today. Today is simply an orientation. And these binders, so you do want to keep them, will be updated throughout the course of discussion on the commercial agreements and when or if the Senate Finance Committee considers the legislation pertaining to gas fiscal terms. So it's my understanding we will have today presenting the commercial agreements Commissioner Rodell, Department of Revenue, and please join us at the table. Commissioner Joe Balash with Department of Natural Resources, Michael Pulaski, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Revenue, and then online, it's my understanding we have Mr. Dan Fauske, who's President of AGDC. Mr. Fauske, are you with us? Okay, he will be with us. He's available for questions, it says here. So before we get started, is there anything else to come before the committee before I turn it over to our distinguished presenters? If not, just so I don't forget, tomorrow, Tuesday, January 28th, we will be hearing from Bill O'Leary. He's the CEO and president of the Alaska Railroad, and we'll be talking about positive train control and some of the capital costs associated with that. So with that, if there's nothing else coming before the committee, Commissioner Rodell, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell, and I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. I'm going to make just a few brief comments and then turn it over to my colleagues on either side. As you noted, there is a binder with a lot of information. We've also included some reference appendixes, such as the Chapter 3 from the Revenue Sources book, which we included on LNG and the LNG market and the history of liquefied natural gas. We would welcome any feedback. If there's other information that you would like to be included in these binders, please feel free to let us know. We're here before you today to talk about specifically the heads of agreement, which was by and among the administration. So myself, as Commissioner of Revenue, Joe Balash as Commissioner of DNR, the three producers, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP, as well as the Alaska Development Gas Line Development Corporation and TransCanada. And I think that as the two gentlemen on either side of me will testify to, this is a groundbreaking achievement for us as the state. And from my own position as Commissioner of Revenue, it's a tremendous opportunity for the state to invest in the long-term financial health for the future of Alaskans And it's a very exciting time for all of us within the state to be working on this. And I know that there's been a long history of trying to commercialize natural gas on the North Slope. And I think that at this point, we've reached a really interesting period. And I think that as you go through these agreements and then as we get to legislation and go through this process, there will be a lot of really good information shared among all of us about that. And with that, I'm going to turn it to Commissioner Balash to speak more specifically.
Thank you. And before we go to Commissioner Balash, I do want to welcome and encourage the members that are listening online through the various teleconferences that if you have any questions, just interrupt us and let us know. As I mentioned, we have several members that were stuck with the weather, so they couldn't join us. But we do have the Senate President here, and Senator Huggins, you're welcome to join us if you like.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. All right, Senator Balash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. And as Commissioner Rodell indicated, this agreement, this body of agreements, does bring all of the parties to the table that are necessary from the buyer's side of the transaction. We ultimately are going to need sellers as well, but what we have is an alignment among those parties to not only bring the gas, the resource itself, to market, but also the expertise and balance sheets to construct the necessary infrastructure. And while Alaskans and specifically legislators have spent an awful lot of time getting to know some of the finer points about pipelines, there are some really key differences about an LNG project that are going to become very important as we make decisions going forward. Those differences between an LNG project and a pipeline are ones that have everything to do with the markets themselves, the contracts involved, and the regulatory matters that affect the operation of the project and the beneficiaries of the project. All of those differences together led us at DNR to commission a study last year on how it is we can protect and maximize the state's royalty interests, specifically the 12.5% plus at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson that would be involved in such a project. The findings of that study, the things that we learned over the course of last year, contributed greatly to the decisions that Commissioner Rodell and I made over the last few months, and you will see show up in our analysis and specific provisions here in the agreements. The biggest takeaway from that study was the nature of our relationship with the North Slope producers and the differences that we had in the commercial structure and financing of the infrastructure itself. Those differences stem from the state's desire to see the lowest tariff possible in order to maximize our royalty value, to maximize our production tax value, and to create access to the infrastructure by third parties. And so when it comes to questions around the commercial structure and financing, we're driven to seek out a position that drives the tariff as low as possible, almost every time. The other parties, however, do not necessarily have that interest. It's not to say that they have an opposite interest, but rather their considerations for structuring the commercial enterprise a particular way and structuring the financing with either more equity or a higher rate of return are driven by their individual business needs as opposed to ours. And so we've had this misalignment for many, many years in this state. And, you know, I can't help but think back to Governor Egan in the early 70s wanting desperately to own at least 1/8 of TAPS so that we wouldn't fight over how our tariffs were set, that we wouldn't have arguments about the way in which the pipeline was operated. And, you know, we fell short in that endeavor. We did not actually wind up owning a piece of TAPS. And there were literally decades of litigation that followed and a harshness to the relationship between the producers and ourselves as a state that has caused a lot of cynicism, a lot of doubt about what they're up to and whether it's in our interest. So what you see embodied in this heads of agreement is a fundamental shift in our approach, that we in fact are going to assert an equity interest in the resource itself and take control of the terms of financing our share of the infrastructure. And I think that that is going to pay huge dividends to the people of Alaska and to the Treasury over time. The specific terms, the specific provisions we'll talk about in a broad sense here in the heads of agreement and legislation to follow. But we're going to take this on a phased approach where we take one step at a time. We bring a set of broad terms forward to this body and the other and seek your approval to advance into the next phase of development and commercialization. Regardless of the specifics of those terms, there are some broad things that matter to Alaskans, regardless of which project we're talking about, regardless of which approach we take. And that's getting gas to our communities and our businesses, identifying terms that will ensure that Alaskans get the jobs and Alaska businesses get the work associated with development of the project, and that we maximize our value as a resource owner and incentivize additional exploration and development beyond the proven resource at Prudhoe and Point Thomson. This agreement, I believe very strongly, achieves each of those goals and objectives and is in line consistent with each one of those. As Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski walks through the overview, I'd encourage the committee to pay particular attention to the provisions in Article 6 that goes to the regulatory and access terms for in-state use as well as third-party access. On page 16, Article 11, the provisions that are specific to Alaska hire, training, and workforce development are included and detailed. And then finally, there's an entire appendix, Appendix A, that speaks to the principles for expansion of the project. Any component of the project, in fact, can be expanded under this outline of principles. So I am quite proud of the work we've done here. I'm excited as to what it means for Alaska's future, and look forward to spending the next 83 days talking with all of you about it. I'll turn it over to Mr. Pawlowski.
Commissioner Balash. Mr. Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Michael Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner to the Department of Revenue. The purpose of the presentation that the committee and members of the public have is really to give the committee, staff, and the public an orientation to how to read the document that's before you, the heads of agreement, the broad roadmap for the development and commercialization of North Slope Natural Gas through an LNG project. There are some nuances to it, and so we wanted to take the time to methodically walk through the sections so that members are comfortable with what the plan is and how this document works. First of all, though, on slide 2, it's important to take a step back and recognize what a heads of agreement is, and more importantly, what it isn't. It's a unifying document. It's an alignment, and it's a roadmap around a vision. It is not a binding legal agreement. As you see, the definition in Investopedia, which I think we appreciate work that members have trusted in pulling that out, it really is a first step in a partnership agreement that represents the first step on the path to those full binding legal agreements. As Commissioner Balash said, we are taking commensurate steps with the partners that are involved in this project towards developing a large-scale LNG project in this heads-up agreement. It is not the end. It is a beginning. And as Commissioner Balash said, the agreement will recognize where along the line the terms will continue to get refined and come back to members of the public and the legislature for consideration. As you see in the cover, it is unique in that it is the first time we've seen the administration, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, TransCanada, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP Exploration come together around a shared vision for the future. Slide 3 is an attachment that is included in Appendix 1B of the Heads of Agreement, which is also available online for members of the public. And I included this slide to give people a feeling for just the scale of the project and the components of the project that are contemplated in this Heads of Agreement. Previous efforts by the state to commercialize North Slope Gas have really focused on two of the components, a treating plant and a pipeline. But as you see, an LNG project is substantially more complicated by the inclusion of the liquefaction plant and a storage and loading facility. Now, this is a world-class, world-scale project. I know something that struck me was when you look at the gas treating plant, you're talking about between 250 and 300,000 tons of steel going into that plant on the North Slope. You're talking about an 800-mile pipeline and a multi-billion dollar liquefaction plant to take the molecules on the North Slope and turn them into a product that can be delivered to generate revenue around the Pacific Rim.
Mr. Pulaski, if I may interrupt just a second. Sure. Senator French, welcome to this Senate Finance. Would you like to join us at the table? Okay, thanks.
Slide 4 describes the organization of the Heads of Agreement. It's broken into 16 sections that include recitals of recent events to give the readers context about the understanding of the parties on what has occurred and what we can look forward to occurring. There are 13 articles governing specific guidelines for the development of the project and the roles and responsibilities of the parties to the agreement. As Commissioner Balash said, Appendix A is a key appendix articulating clear principles for expansion and development of the infrastructure. And finally, an exhibit that provides the three letters that have been shared to Governor Parnell from the producer parties in TransCanada over the past several years as the governor called for alignment around an LNG project and a transition away from the AGIA license. As you read the heads of agreement, though, it's important to recognize who is being referred to. There are some key terms that are used throughout the document. And members of the public following along in the agreement can see on page 2 the real four categories: the administration, parties, Alaska LNG project parties, and the producer parties. In defining who's doing what and where in the agreement and in relationship to the project, it's key to see these terms. And when you're reading the document, be able to organize who's involved. So what I've done is, on the next two slides, put into context, when a word is used and capitalized, who it's referring to. On the one hand, the administration, also commissioners in the state, broadly refers to the Departments of Natural Resources and the Departments of Revenue, but that is the big S state of Alaska. Parties to the agreement include all of the parties who signed the agreement. That's Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, the commissioners, TransCanada, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP Exploration Alaska. However, Alaska LNG parties, you'll notice, includes the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation or a subsidiary of that corporation, TransCanada, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP Exploration, but not the administration. That's important because there is a difference between the state acting in its role as a resource owner and the state acting in its role as a regulator and in the infrastructure. And the deal is specifically designed to respect the role of the agencies really as the managers of the resource, but to recognize that in the longer term, it's not the intent of the agencies to be involved in the day-to-day development operation and running of infrastructure. We have public corporations and we have partners that can do that. And so you'll see in the document where the Alaska LNG parties are used is specifically talking about the ownership of the infrastructure and the capacity in that infrastructure. Finally, reference to the producer parties is when it's specific to the gas resource in the upstream above the project and the development of the Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson fields. That is often used when it's a direct engagement between the departments as resource agencies and the producers as the developers of the upstream assets. After clarifying who is being described in the heads of agreement, the next section is really the recitals. The recitals found on pages 2 through 4 of the heads of agreement really provide a context for the agreement. What has happened, what is happening, and where are we moving to? The keys in the recital section are really first the recognition that circumstances changed with the development of shale gas in the lower 48, and Governor Parnell called on the parties to align around the development of an LNG project. Second, it recognizes that funding by the state under the AGIA license really has supported key activities for this LNG project. There is work that has happened and there is studies and permitting pre-analysis that's been done that does provide value to the LNG project going forward. Third, it recognizes very importantly, as the governor said in his State of the State, that the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation is currently pursuing the ASAP project to provide the ace in the hole and to get gas to Alaskans. That project will cooperate with the larger Alaska LNG project, but ultimately, as you will see in the heads of agreement, provides real value to the development of this larger effort. And that's why the maintenance of Parallel Pass continues to be an important thing, at least throughout the pre-feed stage. Finally, it recognizes that the Alaska LNG parties wish to ramp up the pre-feed phase of the project, which is estimated to cost over $400 million. As members of the public and legislators engage with the heads of agreement, it's important to recognize that when a term is capitalized, it's a specifically defined term in the agreement. And so you can turn back to Article 1, which is the definition sections, to get a clear understanding of what that term is meaning and being used within the heads of agreement. We've put some of the key definitions in the presentation so that members and the public can get familiar with them. But first is the concept of enabling legislation. That references the legislation that was introduced by the governor and addresses some key details and components. The heads of agreement does not describe in specific detail the legislation, but rather really what the legislation needs to accomplish to lay the foundation for the parties to proceed. Those can be found in detail in Article 7. Secondly, the Memorandum of Understanding refers to an agreement between the administration and TransCanada to transition away from the AGIA license and into a commercial relationship to hold and carry the state's interest in the midstream. Pre-feed is the phase of the project that enactment of enabling legislation allows. That's that first big commensurate step into defining and moving the project forward, filling in some of the detail that will allow all of the parties, the state included, to decide whether or not to proceed to the next stage. RIK means royalty in kind. That is a shift required by statute for the Department of Natural Resources to take our gas actually as a molecule and not as a payment in value. TAG, or tax as gas, describes in Article 8.11 a mechanism created by the Department of Revenue that would have to be done in enabling legislation to allow a producer from a specific field to pay their taxes with gas as opposed to with checks as they do in value. With those key definitions, the heads of agreement then moves into Articles 2 and 3, which attempt to set some broad principles and articulate some key benefits to the agreement. It first recognizes that if enabling legislation is passed, the parties, consistent with the roadmap provided in the Heads of Agreement, would advance the project through the pre-FEED stage. And that advancing the project through the pre-FEED stage to development really provides some clear benefits to Alaskans. First, gas to Alaskans, jobs to Alaskans, revenues to the state, and opportunities for additional gas development. As Commissioner Bailash said, those four key state interests have been consistent throughout any effort to commercialize North Slope gas. They are articulated, embodied in the different elements of the Heads of Agreement that he discussed earlier and that we'll get to as we continue through the document. The next article is Article 5, which describes, Article 4, which describes Alaska LNG project work. What is going to happen during the pre-FEED period? That's found on pages 8 and 9 of the Heads of Agreement. It articulates that the pre-FEED stage, the ramp-up of the pre-FEED stage, is expected to last between 18 and 24 months. And that as the governor's called for, those commensurate steps following the pre-FEED stage, there would be a review by each party. Again, here, party is capitalized. The state, just like the producers, just like TransCanada, just like any other party to the agreement, will have to make a decision whether proceeding to the next stage with more information, with more understanding of the project, is in the state's interest. That decision will come sometime between 18 and 24 months from the passage of enabling legislation. But what are some key activities that are going to happen during the pre-FEED stage? There's really four that we see as very, very important to the state. The first is the development of sufficient information to evaluate the technical, cost, and schedule aspects of the LNG project. Today, the public hears an estimate of $45 to $65 billion for the project. At this stage in the project, the companies have, with their partners, defined a concept. They have a good idea of what that concept is. But just like putting blueprints together for your house, there's a lot of work that has to happen to define that detail so that you can take that next step. This pre-FEED stage is really about putting the blueprints together. After that, there needs to be really key project services agreement between the state and TransCanada and AGDC. The resource agencies, DNR and DOR, will have an interest in the gas. We need to work agreements between TransCanada and AGDC to be able to provide transportation services or liquefaction services for that gas. Finally, the parties, that includes the producers, need to develop mutually agreeable gas offtake and balancing agreements. Gas will be produced on the North Slope and provided to the project. There's considerable work that needs to be done between the resource agencies during this pre-FEED stage to define when we get our gas, how it is produced to the state, and what happens if certain gas isn't produced. That's going to take a lot of work and a lot of negotiation, but that process needs to start. But finally, something that does mark an important change in the progression of this project is contained in Article 4. And that's that during this pre-FEED stage, each of the producer parties would initiate preliminary, individual LNG or gas sales or shipping efforts. For the first time that we know of, the individual producer parties are committing here to begin the initial marketing of LNG from Alaska in the Pacific Rim to global markets. An LNG project, as Commissioner Bailash said, is fundamentally different than a pipeline to the lower 48. A pipeline to the lower 48 was going to a very large, very liquid market where the demand for gas was a given. An LNG project is very, very different than that. It's different than that because there is a consolidated group of buyers, and there will either be a market for the gas in which Alaska can compete, or there won't. Over this pre-FEED stage, both the state and the parties individually will be starting to test whether that market exists. Now, many who looked at the Royalty study might remember that one of the state's concerns about taking gas in kind boils down to the state's inexperience in marketing our gas. While the Department of Natural Resources engages in in-kind contracts with groups like Flint Hills or Tesoro to move royalty oil, this is a step change in the complexity of stepping out into the market. The Heads of Agreement contains an important clause in Article 833 that provided the state with comfort that we will be able to work through the potential to support the state's inexperience in that market, because the producers have offered individually to work with the state to develop agreements for the disposition of a portion of the state's LNG. That means the state will be working, have the option, not the foregone conclusion of, but the option of pursuing joint marketing efforts individually with each producer. At the same time, the state retains the option to go out individually and see what other deals are available in the market. But all of that starts as we start to define the pre-FEED stage. Concluding the pre-FEED stage, we will have an idea of whether there is a market and whether Alaskan Gas can compete. Then the decision to take the next step will be up to the state on its portion of this project. Slide 11 comes from the same Exhibit 1B, page 32, as one of the attachments, and the Heads of Agreement, and really puts these phases into context. As members can see today, we are finishing up the concept selection stage of the project. And you see the developments across the top includes several points along the way where each party looks at a decision. Is it ready to go forward? Is the project ready to proceed? Or do we need to take a step back and continue to do some work to see how to make Alaska Gas more competitive? The pre-FEED stage is expected to take between 12 and 18 months, cost between $400 and $500 million. After that, the procedure to the FEED stage is where billions of dollars start to get committed. Again, we will move through the pre-FEED stage and then make a decision to head into the FEED stage. After FEED and those billions of dollars, that's really going from blueprints to picking out the tile and deciding exactly how detailed your construction is going to be. Then the decision to construct happens in the FID stage. And that's when the tens of billions of dollars are committed to the project. As the royalty study found, the next article, Article 5, deals with state participation in the project. State participation in the project really provides what the state and the parties see as a key enabler to the project. And I think this is another place where the legislature's actions with the governor on House Bill 4 last year really put momentum in the right direction. The decision of the state to invest in infrastructure and support the investment in infrastructure really is an enabler because it starts to align the interests. But as Article 5 shows, it really is about more than just aligning the interests. State participation in an LNG context is really about maximizing the value of the state's resources for the people of Alaska. By controlling the molecules, it's about the ability to deliver gas to Alaskans. The article describes how public transparency of the state's approval process provides a different mechanism to advance this project than we've seen before. Investment in the infrastructure does provide an opportunity for additional state revenues because there are returns that come from the equity investments in that infrastructure. The state's ability to share in those returns provides consistent cash as an investment to offset the variability from commodity prices. Finally, it provides the state access as an owner of the infrastructure to the same pro-expansion principles and access to gas and opportunity for capacity to other developers of gas that any one of the parties owning the infrastructure would have. It gives the state a shared and equal place at the table. It improves alignment of interest between the state and the producer parties, and as Commissioner Balash said, really reduces the potential for valuation and other disputes between the state and the producers because we have a transparent mechanism for understanding what the costs of developing and moving our gas to market off. It puts the state in a driver's seat to defend our value. Subsequently, the state will participate in the infrastructure, and this is where it's important to distinguish between the state, capital S, as the agencies, and the public corporations or partners that the state brings in on our behalf. The state agencies are not infrastructure and business entities. We are regulators, we are fiduciaries, and we are the managers of the state's gas interest. What the Heads of Agreement contemplates is that state participation will be through partners that can bring the technical and business expertise to the table on the state's terms and in Alaskans' interests to protect our value in the project. But it won't be the agencies themselves in the long term that are running those business interests. And finally, the article sets a broad range for the state's interest in the gas and the state's interest in the infrastructure, recognizing that the two need to be the same, that the state gas share is a combination of our royalty and tax interests, and that the state's share in the infrastructure needs to be commensurate with whatever the combination of those two mechanisms are to provide the sort of alignment and support for the project. And that would be between 20% and 25% of the total volume, capacity, and gas in the project.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Hawken.
On that point, the 20% to 25%, that would also include 20% to 25% of the construction cost, between $45 to $60 billion.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that's correct. It's the key being the investment in the infrastructure is consistent with the share of the gas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Taking a step back from the state's investment in the infrastructure and achievement of returns through that infrastructure, the state also has an interest as a regulator. A lot of the disputes that have happened over time between the state and industry have been sorted out at the federal or state level in the regulatory approach to the projects. An Alaska LNG project is very different and creates some unique challenges, as articulated in the royalty study, to the state in managing our interests. Article 6 is a critical piece from the state's perspective, particularly from the resource agencies, in defending and maximizing Alaskans' value. And it provides a few broad concepts that drive the project forward. The first is that there are at least 5 offtake points for Alaskans to get access to the gas. The project will provide at least 5 of those points. Most importantly, the locations of those points will be developed in consultation with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Remember, AGDC is pursuing the ASAP line. They are moving towards an open season. The work they do in developing that open season is critical for the state to understand where Alaska needs gas, when Alaska needs gas, and how to get that gas to Alaskans. The work they are doing and will continue to do is very, very valuable to the effort on the larger project. Secondly, each party, the state, BP, Exxon, TransCanada, shares of capacity would be managed on a proprietary basis. What this does is create essentially projects within a project. While it's one piece of infrastructure, each piece is managed on its own basis. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, TransCanada shares are committed at the outset to provide access to third parties on terms developed with the state. That is not to say that the other parties are not going to provide access to third parties. It says the state is taking a step forward at the beginning to say, consistent with the principles in Article 6, Appendix A, the state is looking to open the door for additional exploration and development on the North Slope. Which brings us to, why are these expansion principles so important? Alaska has significant gas resources on the North Slope. While the current known reserves are 35 trillion cubic feet, The USGS estimates that there are 240 trillion cubic feet of technically recoverable conventional gas resources on the North Slope. Those are technically not economically recoverable. There is a difference, but the point is there is potentially a massive amount of gas resource. Maximizing Alaskan's value depends not just on developing the 35 trillion cubic feet, but opening the door to the rest of the gas. The pro-expansion principles in Appendix A guarantees Alaska land beyond Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson will continue to be explored for gas, and the gas will get into the line to benefit Alaskans. And so instead of following consistently with the articles, I'd like to turn to Appendix A in the Heads of Agreement, which is found on pages 21 to 23. These pro-expansion principles commit the parties to a process and principles that can guide a process for the expansion of each component of the Alaska LNG project. Remember, unlike previous efforts, this isn't just a pipeline. This is a treatment plant, a pipeline, a liquefaction plant, and storage and marine terminal facilities. Each one of those pieces is an asset that can be leveraged and expanded to provide access for more gas to be developed. The key to the expansion principles is that each owner in a share of capacity has a right, but not an obligation to expand any one of those components. And that, as you see in the highlighted language here, an expansion can be expanded and an expansion can proceed. As we continue through this process, Mr. Chairman, these principles will get a lot of discussion and a lot of debate. But we believe these form a clear and consistent direction towards the expansion of infrastructure throughout the project and commit the parties to some very pro-expansion principles. They include not just the components such as the pipeline, such as the GTP, but as the public and members look at it, we'll see a separate section that's consistent with the first devoted to the liquefaction trains. And if I can take a moment, Mr. Chairman, those trains are, as you will hear, I believe, from some of the project leads at a future date, are key pieces of infrastructure. They are designed specifically around an exact amount of gas and don't have the same ease of expansion as other pieces do. What you see in the appendix is a commitment that a new train can be installed commensurate with the other trains on the liquefaction site. That's on, I believe, page 23 of the Heads of Agreement. That additional step, that it's not just the pipe, it's not just the marine facilities, but that any owner in the project can expand the LNG, add a new train, really is what drives large-scale additional development. We see that as a major step forward in the pro-expansion and access principles in this Heads of Agreement. After defining the regulatory landscape for the project going forward, the Heads of Agreement also contemplates enabling legislation. What components need to be passed to move the project through a ramp-up of pre-feed? And I think it's important here to take a step back from need to be passed versus what will move people forward. The Heads of Agreement provides an aligned vision around what is necessary to advance the project. It says under these terms, in this construct, all of the parties commit to moving forward. It recognizes, as I said, the Heads of Agreement is a pathway, it's a first step towards those binding commercial agreements. It does not in any way say that this body or the public doesn't have a right and a role to diligence. It says these are the ways that the parties agree the project can move forward. And it provides an important two-stage process through pre-feed. First, the general legislation will be enacted to set general take terms. That would be enacted during the 2014 session. It would also authorize the agencies and AGDC subsidiary to move forward and develop those commercial agreements that are going to underpin the state's participation in the project. It will also enable the resource agencies to actually start to work on developing the commercial agreements around gas that will form the foundation for the project. Those agreements will be developed over time and brought back to the legislature for review and the public for discussion. What I've done is put the timeline. This recognizes a success case. It's clear mega projects are not and shouldn't be schedule driven. What you want is the best work being done to reduce costs and uncertainty throughout this pathway, but this is the plan on a success case. It says April of 2014, the legislature would pass enabling legislation. Between 2014 and 2015, the administration and the Alaska LNG project parties are going to develop these project enabling contracts. And to pause for a second, members will see throughout the Heads of Agreement this reference. In the past, when we've worked on pipeline projects, there's been a presumption that one big bang would get a project. An LNG project is much more complex. Not any one contract will drive and enable this project. It's actually multiple contracts that will be developed. The legislature and the public, part of the debate and discussion in this session, will be what role does everybody have in the review and development of those contracts. Those will be done throughout the pre-FEED stage. In 2015, those will be returned to the legislature to consider. And then in 2015 to 2016, the parties, each individually, will decide whether to advance to FEED. The fiscal terms are designed in Article 8, which for those following along in the Heads of Agreement, is found on page 13, continues through page 15. This sets key terms for royalties and production taxes that establish that state gas share that needs to be commensurate with the state's infrastructure. It first describes our Alaska Statute AS 3805-182A, which directs the Department of Natural Resources to take royalties on oil and gas in kind unless the commissioner determines that taking in money would be in the best interest of the state.
If I can interrupt just for a second, Mr. Nerlowski, Senator Dunleavy has a question, but I also want to welcome Senator Wilikowski to the Senate Finance. You're welcome to join us here at the table. We have a couple members stuck. So if you'd like to join us. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Senator, to the chair, at the conclusion of the pre-FEED stage, what happens if one of the parties decides not to proceed further? Is there a provision that resolves that impasse?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, that's part of the commercial agreements that get developed during the pre-FEED stages, resolving exactly what happens for a coalition of the willing to continue forward. What's important from the state's perspective is the state will retain rights to assets that allow us to continue forward. But it also highlights the importance of our ace in the hole. Why it is so important to keep advancing the ASAP project forward is we don't know fundamentally what happens in the market. The state's been here before. What we have is a group of parties investing, excited about moving a project forward, but we don't have the foregone conclusion yet.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Alaska statute dictates that the Department of Natural Resources take royalties on oil and gas in kind unless the commissioner determines that taking in money would be in the best interest of the state. Knowing that they were going to wrestle with that question, as Commissioner Balash said, the department undertook a royalty study with world-renowned experts to take a look at Alaska's royalty and subsequently production tax issues. And what were some of the issues related to taking that gas in kind? Fundamentally, those came down to the marketing risk. It was the largest issue, the state's inexperience in taking that gas to market and participating in the market. Again, looking back to the agreement in 833 that the producers commit, if asked by the state, to negotiate separate agreements individually to do marketing on behalf of and with the state helps to minimize some of the risk that the state identified in that royalty study. But what Article 8 recognizes is taking gas in kind can provide value to the state, can provide real value to Alaskans. There are risks, and there are things that are going to have to be developed during the pre-feed stage to minimize those risks. But at the same time, we do see the value, and we've set it up where it's incumbent on the producer parties to work with the state to resolve the issues that we see create some of those risks to the state. At the same time, the article provides guidance on the range of the production tax, somewhere between 7 and 13%. In kind will provide that 20 to 25% share. And at this point, I'd say it's important to recognize that production tax is levied after royalty, so it's not a simple addition. If you imagine our royalties on the project or royalty share between Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson is somewhere around 13%. It's not 13% plus a 12% production tax gets you 25%. It's actually 13% plus a higher production tax would get you to the 25%. As the committee considers enabling legislation that comes to the committee, we'll be working through the economic analysis to show you how that works. But it's the combination, again, of production tax and royalty that creates the state gas share. In addition to state participation and moving down a consistent and predictable take on the state gas share, there are other terms that really enable the development of an LNG project. One of the most important is the development of a property tax system for payment in lieu of tax for the project. The administration recognizes this is a major driver to the project, but not something that shouldn't be done, or not something that should be done without input from local communities who share the taxing authority with the state for the majority of the project. So what the heads of agreement contemplates is that the administration would lead in the longer term a consensus building exercise with local governments who also have a taxing authority in this project to develop a payment in lieu of tax to govern how property tax and impact payments will be done throughout the project. It is not our intention to ask the legislature this session to look at this question, but instead recognize that we are going to be working with our partners in local government to develop the concepts and to meet their needs collectively. Again, just like the heads of agreement is working together, the administration recognizes we will be working together with local communities to best define how the benefits will be shared of this project. Finally, the article recognizes that project enabling contracts will really need to be of sufficient duration to support investment decisions, to permit realization of a competitive economic return, to enable necessary financing, and to support gas and LNG sales agreements. I think key takeaway of this concept is with the state as a participant and the state with gas, that gas will be moving through long-term contracts with the market. The state has a significant interest in the durability and predictability of those contracts, given the level of state investment contemplated in moving this project forward. And what we've tried to do in the Heads of Agreement is recognize that the construct of durability needs to be driven by the reasons for it. And the reasons for it, again, are to enable financing. If the state is going to issue debt or enter into financing agreements to finance the infrastructure, there need to be predictable terms that support that financing. So predictability in the longer term will be important to the project, but it's important for specific reasons. Finally, there needs to be general support for the development of necessary infrastructure and other local and state and federal permitting requirements. And the heads of agreement describes a healthy long-term oil business is critical to the continued development of gas. Article 11, as Commissioner Balash said, is a the relatively short and concise article from the state's perspective. This governs key principles that define Alaska hire, Alaska content, and workforce development going forward. I've put on the right-hand side of the slide the key estimates from a letter dated October 1, 2012 to Governor Parnell, which is included in the Heads of Agreement as a exhibit, the estimates of peak workforce for the project. And you'll see that the estimated cost at this stage is between $45 and $65 billion. But the jobs at peak in the producing fields are somewhere between 500 and 1,500. The gas treatment plant between 500 and 2,000. The pipeline between 3,500 and 5,000. The liquefaction plant, 3,500 to 5,000. The storage and loading area, 1,000 to 1,500 jobs. Peak construction workforce on this project will run between 9,000 and 15,000 jobs. Figuring out how to get maximum Alaska hire, maximum Alaska content, is key to the state interest, given the scale of this project and the opportunity it creates for Alaskans. Well, one of the most exciting things about an LNG project that is different than other projects the state has pursued in the past is that there are significant jobs and operations. The Kenai Peninsula Borough is well aware of this today. They see the value of day in, day out, people working at that LNG facility in the Kenai. The LNG plant contemplated by this project is that at an exponential multiplier larger. The project contemplates roughly 1,000 operations jobs during the life of this project, those decades of good jobs that will support Alaska residents and Alaska workers. Key pieces of the Alaska Hire and Content section are the commitment to hire Alaska residents, to contract with Alaska businesses, that the parties are going to participate with the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development to update training plans and provide training through our job centers, but also that the parties commit to negotiate in good faith project labor agreements for the Alaska LNG project. This is a massive undertaking that creates massive opportunity for Alaskans. During the pre-FEED stage, the administration, the project parties, are all going to need to work together to see how best Alaskans and Alaska businesses can benefit. But the principle and the commitment to the principle is in the Heads of Agreement. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I close with a picture of Point Thompson and the sunrise over Point Thompson. As many of you have seen, the development of that field and the development of the gas resource at Point Thompson is a key foundational element for the Alaska LNG project going forward. But I included a line that is in the October 1 letter to Governor Parnell that says, "While North Slope gas commercialization is challenging, working together, we can maintain the momentum towards our shared vision for Alaska." What's exciting about the Heads of Agreement really is the alignment, and the parties are working together to solve problems rather than against each other to create them. Mr. Chairman, with that, I pause to take questions from members of the committee.
Okay, very good, Mr. Pulaski. We do have some questions. I'll go to you here in just a second. Is there a timeline, or is the page 11, is that your timeline? I guess the question I'm going to is, if everything happens like we hope, when would we see construction? 5 to 6 years from now, is that what?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Designee Balash, if you follow the periods for each phase, you've got a range. So 12 to 18 months for pre-FEED, 2 to 3 years for FEED, and then you get to that FID, final investment decision, that would bring on construction. If you take the shortest of those, you would arrive at 2017 for the FID decision. And if you take the longest, you're looking at 2018 or 2019. So construction would begin then shortly thereafter, depending upon some of the lead times required for major pieces and components of the project. But we could see pre-construction activities in that 2018-2019 period.
Okay. Very good. And I may just remind folks, too, that we actually don't have a bill before, so we're not going to go too far in the weeds. The bill is in Senate Resources, and Senate Resources, you're doing the same overview with them this afternoon, is that correct? Okay, very good. First of all, I want to thank you for the presentation. I think you did an excellent job. I guess my only concern is I want to get excited about this, but it seems a bit deja vu in the sense that we've heard it before, either ANGDA, Denali, AGIA, you know, just a different name. There was another one, the Pipeline Authority, the Fairbanks and North Saltboro. But this one is different. Instead of working against the producers, we're working as a partnership, and I'm encouraged by that, and also I'm encouraged in the sense that we'll be owners in the pipeline, which gets us at the table so that we at least know what's going on. So I am encouraged. We do have some leverage with our own bullet line. This one is a little different, and so I am trying to get excited. I am excited. Is there anything else that you can share to help my excitement in the sense that, you know, I'm getting old. I've been hearing this too many times, and I'm done doing cartwheels. But I do want to see a gas pipeline in my lifetime, so go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, there are two things that I would point to with regard to why this is different, and it goes to the producer side of the table. Why are they behaving differently? The first is the settlement agreement for ending the dispute at Point Thompson called for a couple of very key decision points and delivering of activities and on commitments there. The structure of the Point Thompson settlement was an acknowledgement that, in fact, the acreage belongs to the state of Alaska, and if nothing happens, it comes back to us free and clear. No more fights, no more arguments, that there was a certain amount of time that the working interest owners at Point Thompson had to get the field into production initially and then more fully develop it. So the initial undertaking in that settlement agreement was to bring the IPS, the initial production system, online to produce condensate through a cycling program. And that has to be into production and delivering hydrocarbons into the pipeline by 2016. From that point forward, there is a period of time under which the working interest owners have to commit to develop and then commit to a plan to more fully develop the field, because nobody would invest the billions of dollars they're investing now for 10,000 barrels a day. So, what does that more fully developed field look like? There are three options under the settlement. One of them is to expand the cycling program. The second is to blow the field down and take the gas over to Prudhoe for increased oil recovery there. And the third is to sanction a major gas sale project. So, when you look at the economics of those three options for the producers, we think that the most economic proposition for them, the one that's going to make the most for them, is the third one, the major gas sale. So they're highly motivated to keep the property at Point Thompson. And in order to do so, they're going to need to pursue the thing that makes them the most cash. And a major gas sale would do that. So that is, and that commitment has to be made by 2019. That lines up very well with the timelines we're talking about here, progressing through pre-feed, feed, and getting to that final investment decision, which would equate to the sanction requirement in the Point Thompson settlement. So that's number one. And that's for roughly a quarter of the gas in question. Number two is what's going on at Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay is a unique hydrocarbon system on this planet. It's one that has produced billions of barrels of oil for us over the years and has the promise to produce trillions of cubic feet of gas for us. However, the gas has been reinjected for the last 20-some years to recover more oil. And that's been of benefit to the companies, of benefit to us. In the past, when the companies have evaluated various opportunities to commercialize North Slope gas, they've had to take into account the oil that would not get produced if the gas was blown down and sold, because that gas would not be available to recover additional oil. So when they calculated that particular cost, or loss of opportunity rather, it would affect the overall economics in a negative way. What we see in the next decade is that we are approaching the turning point in the field's economics, in the recovery of gas versus oil, that the continued reinjection of Prudhoe Bay gas is going to stop returning the same benefit that it has previously, that opportunity is becoming smaller and smaller. Therefore, the negative hit on the economics from the loss of the economics of the oil is going away, meaning the revenues from the gas are there and unencumbered by oil impacts. It's a long way of saying...
Senator Faircloth, is that you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The doors are closing, and so I'm going to listen for as long as I can, but I wanted to say thank you for a great presentation.
Great. Well, good luck, and hope to see you here soon. Thanks, Senator Faircloth, for joining us.
Thank you.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Backtrack to your last connection.
Sure. So what we see in the profiles of oil production at Prudhoe Bay, along with what would happen in a gas blowdown circumstance, is those oil losses are getting smaller and smaller, to the point that early in the next decade, we hit the tipping point where it starts to make sense to them to produce the gas and sell it without any loss from the oil side. So, without that negative encumbrance, the economics are changing for the companies, and again, it's what's different among them. They want to keep Point Thompson, and the time is right to start blowing down Prudhoe in their eyes.
And you know, another point on that is that a lot of folks don't look for oil in Alaska, don't explore for oil, because typically when you look for oil, you find gas, vice versa. And when you find gas, it's stranded. So if we have a pipeline, I would also think that our oil production potentially could increase as well. I want to go to Senator Hoffman, but go ahead, Mr. Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Pulaski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. I just add to what Commissioner Balash said, that it's not just about what will happen, but it's, I think, things that we are seeing happening today. One, last summer we saw a significant summer field season conducted from Live and Good to the North Slope. We've also seen quietly the company start to pursue land acquisition on the Kenai for the LNG terminal. There are things happening today that give us a bit more confidence than things we've seen in the past. So there are a series of steps that we see that are really reasons to be optimistic and cautiously optimistic about this project moving forward.
Okay, very good. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to concentrate on the jobs for a minute. On page 11, your jobs at the high end says that there's right around 17,000 jobs. But then on page 19, the high end, the number of jobs is 30,000 compared to the 17,000. I wonder if you could rectify for me later on what's the discrepancy and how are those reconciled? And the other is on page 19, can you put those into conceptual, the concept sections and the pre-feed, the feed, and obviously the peak construction is the same. The time frame here is 8 to 12 years, and there are these are large numbers for jobs. What is the state doing to prepare Alaskans for these jobs? Because the time frame, even though it may seem a long time frame, you know, as time goes on, this can be compressed, and even in the short run, there are hundreds of jobs. And my question, I guess, is what are we as a state doing to prepare Alaskans for these jobs? And if they aren't prepared, it's one thing to have Alaskan hire, but if they the Alaskans aren't qualified for those jobs, it's hard for them to take those jobs.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, you're absolutely correct. And fortunately, as part of the previous efforts that have been undertaken by the state, we have a lot of work that's been done to prepare us for this question and prepare us for these times. Your committee colleague, Senator Bishop, formerly the Commissioner of Labor, assembled a strategic workforce training plan that took a detailed look at the occupations that will be created by the various phases of a project. And he even had the foresight to include what it might look like in an LNG construct. His successor, Commissioner Bloomer, has stayed on top of this effort just recently, I think in the last 6 weeks even. That particular training plan, strategic training plan, has been updated. And as far as the specific timing goes, we want to make sure that we train people at the right time to get the jobs and not jump into it too quickly. Otherwise, we're going to be training people to go build lines in Oklahoma and Texas. I'm certain that we will be able to get her in front of this committee to be more specific than that.
Anything else? Mr. Chairman. Okay. Yes, I'm sure if Senator Bishop was here, he would be all over that question. He gave me a tour of the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center this summer, a couple tours, actually, and they're getting geared up. It's pretty exciting stuff. Senator Kelly, did you have a question? Okay. Senator Dunlap.
Through the chair, thank you. Commissioner Bailash, you, I think you said something significant earlier, that something's changed in the minds of the producers at Prudhoe in a sense that where gas's value was once being used to keep pressure on the oil fields to produce more valuable oil, that there's a belief that that is going to change over the next decade, and that gas itself will now become more valuable than using it as a vehicle to get oil out of the ground. The exercise that we went through last year, how does that jive with the gas approach this year? In other words, we are anticipating and hoping for more production. Is that more production in oil? Is that predicated upon the long use system of reinjecting gas, or is there another approach?
The chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think the specifics for any investment decision are going to vary case by case. But what the legislature accomplished through Senate Bill 21 is to take what was a moving tax rate with corresponding moving deductions and stabilize the horizon so that investment decisions could be made with an eye to the longer term. And some of those decisions go to the in-field activities at Prudhoe Bay and will allow the decision-making to proceed in a more straightforward manner. And
Why is that important? Well, from a regulatory perspective, the AOGCC is going to care an awful lot about whether or not the oil has in fact been maximized at Prudhoe. And there are investments that need to be made to get to that point. With those investments showing up, and we're seeing the front end of that in the increased activities, the pre-planning and engineering activity that is going on, as well as the arrival of new rigs to increase the drill count in the field, we're seeing the investment necessary to accelerate black oil production at Prudhoe Bay that gets us through the gate and allows us to proceed with blowdown of the gas.
Mr.
Deputy Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Pulaski. And if I can just add something to what Commissioner Balash said, and it's really important to distinguish between the Prudhoe Bay initial producing area and the Prudhoe Bay unit. Some of the things BP has talked about in response to Senate Bill 21, for example, is the pilot project at the Sag River Formation, which is another strata of oil that is within the Prudhoe Bay unit but not part of where the gas is that Commissioner Balash is representing. That's 200 million barrels of oil that they've described. So there are developments within the Prudhoe unit that are different than the gas relationship that Commissioner Balash described that we see as really good reasons for optimism around oil production coming along with gas production.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Kelly.
If we go back to ACES, would this construction of this thing qualify for tax credit? How massive would it be? Excuse me.
Senator Kelly, I don't want to, for the record, Mike Pulaski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue again, I don't, through the chair, don't want to delve too deeply into where the enabling legislation is since it's not before the committee, but there are concerns about where the definition of point of production is for the purposes of the production tax. The reason that matters is things upstream of the point of production are eligible for capital credits, or were eligible for capital credits. I forget, it's January 2014 sometimes. They were eligible for capital credits, and they were eligible as a deductible lease expenditure. That could pull portions of the gas treatment plant or the transmission lines into that upstream credit and deduction area. So I think that's a long way of saying I'm not sure if that's an ACES question or just a point of production question within the tax system, but it is things that the departments have been very cautious and focused on, because where that line is drawn of what's creditable and deductible really does matter.
Thanks.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, in addition, one thing that we can identify that is definitely an ACES aspect or characteristic is the way progressivity is calculated. It's the tax rate that changes under ACES that goes up as profitability goes up is increased as a function of the profitability of the oil on a per barrel basis. And it's a per barrel of oil equivalent. If you introduce gas production into the equation, and that gas on a per barrel basis is not as profitable as the oil, what you have is the decoupling effect that actually got quite a lot of attention around here back in 2010, and you would have the potential to see some strange things happen with regard to the tax rate applied to the hydrocarbons. It's one of the complications that would make life much more difficult to figure out how to approach some of the key questions here, especially the state's share of the gas from an equity perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you. So it's my understanding that if initially most of the gas would come from Point Thompson and then blended with the Prudhoe gas. What is the blended royalty? Because I understand there's different royalties at different fields up there.
Mr. Chairman, the royalties at Prudhoe Bay are generally and mostly 1/8 royalties, meaning 12.5%. At Point Thompson, they are mostly 1/8 leases at 16 2/3. Some are 1/7 at 14 and 6/7. The exact ratio for the project is something that's going to depend an awful lot on the decisions made by the AOGCC. The operators of these fields are going to have to come forward and secure offtake allowances from the commission, and those offtakes are potentially going to be approved in different time sequences. And so exactly which field will produce first is unknown at this point. But Point Thompson certainly is a field that has a tremendous amount of gas at high pressure and would be capable of producing at a fairly high clip initially. But that's going to depend on what we learn in the IPS phase at Point Thompson. If we find through the cycling effort that, in fact, there's additional cycling required before we go to blowdown at Point Thompson, then we're probably going to have to look at Prudhoe gas first. Those are the kinds of things that need to be refined during this due diligence period of pre-feed and then feed.
Okay, very good. And then what's the regulatory body that would oversee the pipeline, FERC, or is it RCA, or?
Mr. Chairman, that is a very interesting question and one that we spent many, many hours discussing, especially in the month of December. And what I can tell you is the regulatory jurisdiction is what it is. It is either entirely FERC Section 3, some combination of FERC Section 3 and FERC Section 7, or FERC Section 3 NRCA. The law and the jurisdiction asserted by the respective agencies will dictate. And we see where Section 3 can fit over the entirety of the project and allow us to achieve all of the things that matter to us as a state. But just because we might agree and the producers might agree that it should be Section 3, it's going to be up to the FERC to decide that ultimately, because if, in fact, the FERC has jurisdiction and they assert it, it's supreme to the RCA.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Because I have one more. TransCanada, it's a great company, can certainly build pipelines, but a lot of companies can build pipelines. I'm assuming by having TransCanada be a partnership in this project that we are totally out from under the AGIA obligation. Is that a safe assumption?
Mr. Chairman, we have basically pre-agreed with TransCanada to terminate the license upon passage of the enabling legislation to transition from one to the other.
Okay. Very good. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Chair. Along those lines, so what happens to the remaining money that was dedicated towards that agreement? Does it shift to this agreement?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, there is no obligation to reimburse the remaining $170 to $200 million that's authorized under the AGIA license. The information that's been developed under the license that is pertinent and relevant to AKLNG is going to be contributed to AKLNG.
By the state?
I'm sorry, by the licensee.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Let's see, Senator Olson, Senator Bishop, we're online. I understand Senator Fairclough finally got on the airplane, so she's not available anymore. Did you folks, if you're still with us, have any questions?
No, Mr. Chairman. Listen, listening intently. Good discussion, and I'll wait till I'm there in person because we'll get a lot more cracks at this.
Okay. I know.
Chairman, I did have a question for the Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, Senator Olson here.
You say you do have a question, Senator Olson?
Actually, I do, yes.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
I'd like to go ahead with my question.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, and that has to do with at what point are we to know it, you know, on a one-way street down becoming a committed partner to the project, or how far into the project can the state of Alaska go before we can, you know, step out of the way or disembark from the journey that's going to be taking them into the pipeline stage?
Did you hear that?
I think I did, Mr. Chairman. As I understood the question, Mike Pulaski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, the question that was asked was at what point in the project it becomes a one-way street for the state and the state doesn't have the ability to step away. And I just want to make sure I'm clear on the question before I answer it.
Does that sound correct, sir?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Senator Olson, through the chair, again, one of the defining characteristics of this process is that there are multiple points along the path where the state has an opportunity to take a step away from the path that we are on. The commitment being contemplated in the heads-of agreement is a commitment through the pre-FEED stage. That's the next 12 to 18 months, roughly $400 to $500 million of all the parties spending, not just the state, but all of the parties investing their capital. After that, you would go into the FEED stage. The FEED stage would take 2 to 3 years, be in the few billions of dollars shared amongst all the parties. After the FEED stage, there's another opportunity to take a step away. Once you get to FID, the final investment decision, even in FEED, it gets a little difficult because there's long lead time items being ordered. The investment and the ability to step away is never given a, the state always has the ability to step away. The cost of stepping away gets higher the farther we get into the project, simply because the state's invested in the project. But in the near term, we're looking at 12 to 18 months, a share of $400 to $500 million with 75 to 85% carried by the other parties.
Follow-up, Senator Olson?
That pretty much answers the question that I do have. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Senator Olson. And I know, Senator Bishop, you're chomping at the bit to tell us about the training and the labor that would be needed and necessary for this project. And so if you want to wait till you get here, that's fine. Senator Dunleavy?
To the chair, and just going back one more step to the AGEA agreement, again, if you could just clarify, at what stage in the pre-FEED does that agreement, as we know it now, cease and then it evolves into this process? At what stage? The initial, right out of the bat, right out of the gate?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the Commissioner of Revenue and myself have signed an MOU with TransCanada. And under the AGEA statute, the two of us are vested with the authority to abandon the AGEA license. There's a couple of ways to do that. And what we have outlined with TransCanada is the process itself will involve the passage of the enabling legislation, abandonment of the license, and execution of a precedent agreement for transportation service. And so there's a progression that will take place, but it starts with passage of enabling legislation.
So it's a three-step process, is what I just heard. Enabling legislation.
No, Mr. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the agreement to terminate the license is triggered by passage of the enabling legislation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Mr. Foskey, and I believe you're joined with Miles Baker in Anchorage with AGDC. Was there any comments you wanted to make on behalf of...
Not at this time, Mr. Chairman. I've listened to the presentation, and pretty much everything's been covered. This is Dan Fowsky, President of AGDC.
Very good. Dan, thank you for joining us today. Well, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, thank you, Commissioners, Deputy Commissioner, for joining us and giving us a high-level overview of an exciting project. And we'll be hearing more about this. And I know you are, again, for those who maybe wanted to want to hear it again or miss something, they will be presenting again in Senate Resources this afternoon. And we'll be meeting again tomorrow morning with the Alaska Railroad. If there's nothing else to come before the committee at this time, we're adjourned.